Okay, so, hey, this microphone is actually really better. That's perfect. Okay, in my hands, the future of sex. Perfect new microphone. And please sit down. And a big applause for Douglas Spink, our next speaker. Okay, so Douglas will actually talk about science fiction and cross-species sexuality, the uncrossed boundary, and I hope you enjoy the talk, and I hope we have like some controversy later on, and we can talk about it, okay?
Yeah, I'm good at that.
Okay.
I'm the controversy guy, so, wow. Okay. Better? Hello? Test.
Yeah.
Seems good, right? Loud enough, not too loud, okay. I don't know, looks fine to me. So we'll get started. I should probably out myself. I can hear it squealing. Just get closer. The more it squeals. Okay, well there, it shows how much I know. I'm one of the, I hate to say anti-singularity people, because I'm not anti-singularity, but I should out myself as one of the people who posts pages and pages of responses to lots of the articles on H+, which I think is a great magazine, and I just wanted to say that right off the bat. But I'm the guy who seems to be the, yeah, it's actually more complicated than that, response to every one of the articles on biocomputation and stuff like that. My official academic background is in complex systems theory nowadays, though I've been almost finishing my doctorate for 7 years, so a little bit lapsed, I think, yeah. Officially lapsed at this point, I believe. My name's not even on the website at the school anymore, which gave me a sign that they'd really given up on me for the time being. In that role, I have done a lot of work on algorithmic information theory, Kolmogorov complexity, and set theoretic reconstructability analysis. And one of the critiques that I have of some of the simpler versions of singularity stuff is that it ignores the fact that we've basically hit a complexity wall in the world of software engineering. And no matter how much faster our computers are getting, we don't really know how to make more complex things that actually work. And we all know this is true, and it's empirically true, and we know why it's true, even if you read Wolfram's A New Kind of Science. I mean, it all kind of fits, and we don't really have clever ways to resolve this right now that are really proven. And so, I mean, Kurzweil, bless his heart, an interesting guy, wrote some speech recognition software that didn't really work. It didn't. I bought it. It didn't work for a long time. And a brilliant guy, but the singularity stuff just seems to me like it's a little bit built on a house of cards in terms of the empirical quantitative data that it rests on. And anyway, I'm one of those people who was being annoying and responding to lots of those articles. So I didn't want to be sitting here hiding behind a screen name and knowing that I have caused trouble in comment postings there. But it's a wonderful resource because it's asking good questions, and I think that's a key. I'm using the topic of cross-species sexuality in the science fiction literature for exactly the same sort of reason, looking to ask good questions and to generate interesting perspectives, no more and no less. I should say right off the bat that there's some spoilers in this. So if you haven't read some of the more abstract, hard science fiction literature and you're completely panicked that you might find out some plot point of some book that was written in the 1950s and, oh my God, it's going to ruin your life and you're just going to go storming out, then you just have to stop now because I might do that. I could give you a list of the books, you know, if you really need to know that in advance, but anyway, spoiler alert. Not that bad, but still, spoiler alert. And the notes I'm using for this talk, by the way, are posted on the Twitter hashtag earlier today. So if anybody wants to have the version of the notes that I'm using to do the talk, it's already there, so you don't have to take notes or anything like that unless you want to. And there's no presentation stuff or fancy slides or PowerPoint presentations or anything like that. It's just me talking about stuff from some notes. It's one thing I think I know how to do without screwing it up too badly, so I stick with that. As a species, we use stories for more than just entertainment, and I think that's probably not a surprise to anybody here. In fact, it turns out that we use stories as a critical component of our cognitive framework to allow us to make sense of the world we live in, and in particular the social world we live in. We use stories as efficient tools for dissemination of inherited wisdom from generation to generation. We use stories basically as surrogates for algorithmic information in our species, because it's a lot easier to learn an algorithm than it is to try to memorize by brute force all the possible outcomes of all the possible things. If you think about Aesop's fables with the fox and the hare and so on and so forth, they teach us important lessons by encapsulating a concept in a compressed form. And science fiction, I think, does that for our culture nowadays quite a bit. It is a tool for exploration of new ideas, but it's also a normative tool for teaching us important things about what it means to be a technological species. And it does that in a way that is a lot more powerful than I think sometimes we give it credit, because it has become so much a part of our cultural framework. Other species do use stories also to teach each other, but more first person than third person. And I was thinking on the plane on the way down this morning of examples of the dogs in my family teaching each other tricks from one another, usually bad things I don't want them to do. And if one figures out a way to do something that's particularly annoying, before you know it, the other six have got it all figured out, and it just spreads like wildfire because they watch each other. And they learn through observation, because they're a social species, and humans are a social species. We're mammals too, and we also learn by watching each other. But we can do that at a second order. We can learn by listening to each other's stories. And then we can start making up stories that didn't actually happen, so we can teach people, you know, stories and tricks about stuff that never took place. And this is where sort of human culture starts from. And this is a core part of human culture, and that's why reading the science fiction and looking for interesting perspectives, I think, is worthwhile, because these are our modern stories and have been for a number of decades, especially in the technological realm. For that reason, I decided that really what I'm doing today is presenting a Monte Carlo simulation using the science fiction literature as a tool for exploring the landscape of probability. Or potentiality within the question of cross-species sexuality in our culture today. That's my formal statement of theoretic intent. In reality, I'm just going to talk about sci-fi and different approaches to cross-species questions and what that says about sci-fi and sexuality in general in our culture. I'm sticking specifically to science fiction here because if I started to bring fantasy literature in, it just gets too big. And it gets too diffuse and doesn't have the sharp edge that science fiction has. I think fantasy is more about our history in a nutshell. I think fantasy talks about who we are with different prisms that we can look through. And then science fiction, super overgeneralized, talks about who we think we're going to be in the future, which are both ways of talking about who we are today, of course. But when I look through the cross-species fantasy literature, it's just absolutely overflowing. I mean, really, just overflowing. I couldn't even start to do an hour presentation on it to do it justice. I could do an hour presentation on Robin Hobb's Assassin's Apprentice trilogy and not get done with that. Whereas in the science fiction literature, in decades of reading and taking notes on these topics, I have three pages. So this is a targeted approach, and I think that's what makes it somewhat interesting, as much what we don't find as what we do, which is what I'm driving for as I go forward in the presentation. But it is pretty much science fiction. That means I've left out most of Piers Anthony's work, which has got a lot of interesting stuff in this space. And he's an interesting writer, and he writes kind of on that border. A lot of people do, and so it's hard to really say. You know, David Brin, I think he's more science fiction in most of his stuff, but I left his stuff out because I actually gave his books away to a friend of mine and couldn't get them back. So I didn't mean to leave Brin out. He's an important component, and he's got a lot of dolphin stuff that actually is pretty cutting edge in how he looks at things. So that's most of my introduction. I'm going to try to keep, if anything, personal questions and sort of personal perspectives to the side so that I can get through the context here. That said, my unique perspective on this presentation, perhaps, is that I am a little bit equivalent to Andrew, or to Sachs's Anthropologist on Mars, in that most of my bonds throughout my life since I was a kid have been with horses and with dogs. I grew up with horses, riding horses, competing on horses in a horse family. Mildly autistic Asperger's syndrome, and just bonded always better, you know, with the four-leggers and the two-leggers my whole life. And so I kind of sit the boundary, species boundary a little bit. I'm definitely, you know, a human and do human stuff, but I also tend to look at things with a slightly different angle because I spend all day, every day with non-humans, way more than humans. I'll go weeks at a time without actually seeing human beings in real life. And from that perspective, watching humans talk about sex is always fascinating in how confused the whole conversation can be, because humans are really not self-aware about their sexuality at all in a general context, and have a difficult time placing it in context of evolved life on our planet. Because, stop and think about this, the majority of species, at least, though maybe not biomass, reproduces sexually. Not just the animals, which is sort of interesting. I mean, the vast majority of plants do as well. So sex is not unique to us. Sex is not even unique to animals. The majority of plants in the plant kingdom, other than like algae and stuff like that, that are very ancient, also reproduce sexually. So this is a trick that life figured out a long time ago and has spun out into many different variations, and is essential to natural selection. And is, in fact, sexual selection was... In Darwin's initial presentation of his findings, an equal force to natural selection, equal but separate. And we've sort of lost track of that quite a bit, because we think of natural selection and then sex is just a reproduction thing. It's really not. It's front and center to how life works on this planet. I keep thinking they're coming for me, so I'm looking over my shoulder. And humans fit into a constellation of sexuality and sexual behavior that is well fleshed out across, we'll even leave the plants out for now, the animal kingdom. And there's very little that humans do sexually that is unique in any meaningful way. There's examples of all of this spread out there. And 20 years ago, you would have said that, and I think it was controversial. I guess you could still say that now, and people would argue. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, having veterinarians argue with me that animals don't enjoy sex. It was a fact. They don't. It's been proved. You know, they don't enjoy sex. They do it because they have to. It's just an urge, and the Skinnerian, behaviorist thing. And it's just funny that you could actually say that with a straight face, you know. And even today, you'll get that from some veterinarians that'll tell you these things, these facts that aren't true. Because humans get to sexuality, and it's a little bit like trying to look at yourself in the mirror, through a recursive loop, and it's hard for us to see that it's so much a part of who we are that we're have a difficult time being objective about it. Consequently, stepping back and trying to look at sexuality through the prism of how other species deal with the question, and then how our dealing with the question intersects with other species dealing with the question, I think it's useful, because it puts us more in a grounded framework, rather than just floating around out there as sex as being this big thing with a capital S on it that is uniquely human and uniquely complicated and uniquely frustrating and uniquely this and it's not unique. It's frustrating and challenging and complicating, and it's a central part of who we are, but it is not specific to our species at all. Most of the manifestations that I think the average human person nowadays who isn't following the ethological literature and species reproduction and so on and so forth probably think that there's more uniqueness in how humans express sexuality than compared to other species than there actually is. And this shows up in the sci-fi literature, and this will be one of the themes that I kind of touch on a few times as we go forward. I got to keep talking, or I guess it'll do that. Okay, that's the stage has been set. Talk and talk fast, because if I stop, it's going to squeal at me. So why does cross-species stuff have anything whatsoever to do with sex and technology? I mean, this is a sex and technology conference, after all. And I'm going to read a quote from something, and then I'm going to follow up on that before we jump into the quotes from the specific books I'm going to use as examples. The book that I'm quoting from is called The Companion Species Manifesto. It's by Donna Haraway, who was the author of The Cyborg Manifesto, which was amazingly powerful when it was published in 1985 as a sort of a statement of post-feminist, radicalist, cyborg politics, I guess you could say, an interesting book and a powerful book today, even to read. And Haraway has sort of moved past cyborg stuff to companion species stuff because she's decided that that's kind of the natural next step. Cyborg sort of blurs into companion species, and she says the following. Cyborgs, she goes back to explain some of her earlier work. Cyborgs are cybernetic organisms named in 1960 in the context of the space race, the Cold War, and imperialist fantasies of techno-humanism built into policy and research projects. When writing the Cyborg Manifesto, I tried to inhabit cyborgs critically, i.e. neither in celebration nor condemnation, but in a spirit of ironic appropriation for ends never envisioned by the space warriors themselves. Telling a story of cohabitation, coevolution, and embodied cross-species sociality, this present manifesto asks which of the two cobbled-together figures, cyborgs or companion species, might more fruitfully inform livable politics of ontologies and current life worlds. These figures are hardly polar opposites. Cyborgs and companion species each bring together the human and non-human, the organic and the technological, carbon and silicon, freedom and structure, history and myth, the rich and the poor, the state and the subject, diversity and depletion, modernity and postmodernity, and nature and culture in unexpected ways. Besides, neither a cyborg nor a companion animal pleases the pure of heart who long for better protected species boundaries and sterilization of category deviants. And that's Haraway basically making the same argument that I'm trying to make today, that cross-species questions and cyborg questions are blurring into each other more and more. And in fact, the science fiction literature really directly speaks to that as it has pursued these questions deeper into the possibility space. What I'm going to do is read some quotes from a pretty broad spectrum of science fiction work, mostly towards the harder edge of the spectrum. And I've set up a conceptual 2x2 matrix, because it's so much fun to do 2x2 matrices, because humans think in 2x2 terms. And if I had a whiteboard behind me, I would draw a vertical line, and this would be my sort of politics line. And the bottom of the vertical line would be marked conservative, sort of old school, old fashioned historical politics, historical social perspectives. And then the top of the vertical line is orthogonal, which would be sort of more an open-ended, open-minded, socially unconstrained view of social relations. And then my horizontal line on one side is individualistic, which is sort of an inward-focused conception of what sexuality is about. And then the other end of that line is the other, with a capital O, other. And that 2x2 matrix sort of maps out, I think, the landscape of where we can put various science fiction authors when they're talking about sexuality in general, but cross-species sexuality in particular. And I'm going to jump into the quotes by starting with something from Greg Egan, written in 1995, a short story called Wang's Carpets. And he makes another great starting point for what we're doing today. He says, the real test wouldn't come until the diaspora, or the Gleisner robots, finally encountered conscious aliens, minds entirely unrelated to humanity, observing and explaining the universe that human thought had supposedly built. Most ACs, and I'll explain the term in a minute, had come right out and declared such a find impossible. It was the sole falsifiable prediction of their hypothesis. Alien consciousness, as opposed to mere alien life, would always build itself a separate universe, because the chance of two unrelated forms of self-awareness concocting exactly the same physics and the same cosmology was infinitesimal, and any alien biosphere that seemed capable of evolving consciousness would simply never do so. ACs is a term he uses, the anthropocosmologists, that version of imagining that human beings, by being conscious, sort of create the universe around themselves as an artifact of their consciousness. Sort of a different flavor of the there's a computer program running, and we're all in the program, the Matrix. You know, I have to do the dodging thing in slow motion because you mentioned the Matrix. You have to do that. Anthrocosmology actually is a real component of some deeper fringes of mathematics, the concept in quantum dynamics that by observing the universe, we create the universe. And if you take that to extremes, the universe is sort of an artifact of human consciousness, which kind of assumes that there's only humans that are conscious, because otherwise you'd have a bunch of different universes. And what if you bumped into another conscious species? Do you live in different universes? The interesting question and the interesting point that I bring Egan in, because he asked this interesting question about a deep cosmological issue, is that there's, of course, conscious life all around us every day on this planet that isn't human. And 10 years ago, that was sort of controversial. Like, well, no, humans are the only conscious species. Well, no, they're not. And that's now been proven by the cognitive ethology pretty definitively. And that bubble of sort of consciousness is getting bigger and bigger in terms, depending on how you define it and who's doing the research and so on and so forth. But this idea of consciousness being uniquely human has fallen apart. We live on a planet that has lots of conscious species, probably conscious in different ways than we are to various degrees, probably all mammalian to so far that we know. But to imagine that we have to go to other worlds to find other consciousness to see how they would view the universe is kind of funny, because we live in a world with other consciousnesses that we just ignore or kill or whatever on a regular basis. And we've kind of put these blinkers on and said we're the only thing that matters on this planet, and we have to go somewhere else to find interesting stuff. Not really true. And I think Egan himself sort of skips over that in 1995, at least, and you'll see a little bit of a temporal progression in some of this. He's trying to get his head around, the classic question of what happens when you meet aliens. And my rejoinder to that tends to be, well, we live on a planet with aliens already, and we don't know what to do with them. So heaven knows what's going to happen if we meet real aliens out there. We probably wouldn't even recognize them as alive. Worse yet, we live on a planet with real interesting aliens, and you kill them and do like bad things to them. So if we meet another species, we're going to have a hard time explaining exactly how we've behaved here. Is something that I think William Gibson has written a little bit on in some of his more recent stuff. So what I'm going to do now is start reading quotes, and I'll tell you the author and the year, and then I'll read the quote, and then we'll see if anybody can place the quote in my 2x2 matrix that is behind me on the virtual whiteboard. Again, the vertical line is a sort of a social politics, strict to open-ended. And then the horizontal line is sort of self-focused sexual technology versus other sexual technology. That horizontal line points out the obvious fact, and actually the singularity discussion hit this, that is the ultimate form of sex having sex with another version of yourself, or is the ultimate form of sex having sex with the ultimate other? Probably not an either or, really, but two different ways of looking at sexual interaction. Is sexual interaction about that bond with the other, or is sexual interaction about improving the quality of the orgasm for the self? You could almost say that was sort of a male-female question, too. But that's my horizontal axis there. And you'll see that in some of this writing, and in particular, in the technologists tend to veer more towards the individual concept of sexuality and can sometimes lose the whole idea that there's an other in here altogether. And we'll see a few examples on the spectrum where that's not true. But this is sort of a running quiz, so I'm going to start reading quotes, and then you guys can help me put them on the conceptual framework behind me on the wall. We're going to start with a book that was cited in the anthology, which I just had a chance to catch up on this morning, as one of the weirder examples of one of the weirder writers in science fiction, I'd have to agree, Philip Jose Farmer, who did the Ringworld trilogy, among others, and then got weird as he went. Actually, he started weird. I mean, in 1961, this was written, Strange Relations, sort of a novella, and he's talking about a setup where a hero, a male white hero, falls for and has a heated love affair for a buxom, good-looking white female woman who also cooks very well and is a great wife. He makes a big point of that. And then finds out, shockingly enough, that she's actually an insect species that has evolved on another planet to perfectly mimic human physiology. So the question is, like, how what's the moral implication of the fact that he has had sex and fallen in love with an insect? But the insect is a perfect replica of a human being. So you get into this sort of, is this really an other or not question? And we're going to hit this quite a bit. So the quote is discussing that general concept. And he says, yes, you have, with a thing that is even lower than a beast of the field, the insect. what even Moses did not think of when he forbade union between man and beast, what even the forerunner could not have guessed when he reaffirmed the law and set the utmost penalty for it. You have done. You slept with an insect. And there's a big crisis in strange relations. I mean, the whole crux of the novella is, does she really count as a being or not? And should this character be completely humiliated by the fact that he has had carnal intercourse with something that he really thought was human, but it turns out it wasn't? And there's another quote from the same novella, and then we'll place them on the chart. If you knew she were of an utterly alien branch of the animal kingdom, separated by millions of years of evolution, barred by her ancestry and anatomy from the true completion of their marriage, children, you would turn from her with horror. That belief must have shot the darkness of even her brightest moments, because she was trying to hide the fact that she was an insect from him for so long, and then when he finally finds out that she's like made of chitin and stuff, she breaks down and cries and says, well, I knew you'd hate me if you found out I was a bug. And he kind of does, actually, which doesn't really, you know, in 1961, and the whole, you know, novella kind of falls apart, and she dies, and it's all horrible, and it's because she was an insect, and, well, the moral of the story is don't sleep with insects, I guess. 1961, this is an early, example on our chart here. Where do we put this on the chart behind me? A vertical scale between conservative and sort of open-ended social thinking? Pretty far down on the conservative side, and Farmer, for all of his weird writing, is pretty conservative in the way he looks at his weirdness. Focused on the individual, the self, or focused on a true other with a capital O. Self, very much. I mean, the whole question is this other? Can we convince ourselves that this other is close enough to us that it doesn't really count as an other? So I mean, the whole idea here is that if it's too other, it's just bad. That's just bad. Don't do that. Bad. Moses said that was bad. That's bad. So now we get to 1968, and Philip Jose Farmer, I always imagine, has taken a lot of LSD by this point, though I don't know if that's true. I just tell myself this because I've read a lot of his work. And he gets really explicit in this book that he wrote, so fair warning if there's people here who are easily bothered by dirty words. Yeah, I figured, but just say that. Image of the Beast is the name of this book, very difficult to find, basically out of print. Deeply pornographic, written in 1968, out of print for like 25 years, I think, after it was initially published, and bizarre in a lot of ways. I could try to tell you the storyline here, and it would take 20 minutes to even explain, but it involves a guy whose semen is used to power a spaceship that does transdimensional time warps and gets people back to their home world. There's a chalice that he has to fill up, and that's the normal. That's the easy part. It gets weirder after that. I mean, like, really weird. Almost hard to follow weird. But it's pretty much, hardcore porn in the writing. And there's two examples of cross-species stuff in here, and then we'll see where this fits on the scale. The first example, quoting one of his protagonists, I went up the hill and looked down in a hollow, and there was a female wolf, her head in four nooses, and the ends of the nooses tied to trees. She couldn't go back or forward, and there was Glam, all his clothes off except for his socks and shoes, which is just a weird picture, holding the wolf by the tail and fucking her. Glam, that animal Glam, was fucking her. So Glam is like this half-human, kind of a weird, super alien thing. And part of what Farmer is trying to emphasize is that he's so half-human that he's actually raping this wolf. And, like, this is sort of a double up. Not only is it cross-species, but it's rape and it's bad, and it just shows how bad Glam is. And Glam ends up being really bad. In fact, the protagonist ends up having a bit of an encounter with Glam, too. While he is sleeping with somebody who he thinks is his wife, again, another Farmer classic here, this is what happens. The white body beneath him became reddish. The smooth but wet, slippery skin was covered with hairs as red as an Irish setter's and as wet as if it had just climbed out of the water. The face became elongated and snouted. The long head hair shrank to a bristle. The eyes shifted towards the sides of the head. The small and delicate ears became large, hairy, pointed organs. The long-fingered, well-manicured hands of his wife, that he thought, became paws with blunt, hooked nails. The legs on his shoulders became hairy, and a big hard penis was against his body. It was spurting jism over his belly and down onto his own cock. This is like there's pages of this stuff. Which was buried to the hairs in the hairy anus of the creature. It was too late for him to stop. He exploded inside the red-haired ass of the creature. There's like hundreds of pages of this. That's the milder stuff from this. So that's an interesting example where he thinks he's sleeping with his wife, but instead he's sleeping with an alien species who turns into what sounds like kind of a actually handsome Irish setter, to be honest. Nice hair and, you know, smooth, lustrous coat and the whole, you know, word. And quite an if you envision the way they're actually coupled, it's interesting, you know. I've seen porn like that, actually. Male, too, to boot. And Farmer has a weird sort of homophobic thing going on. So that is in 1968, and where do we put that on the vertical scale? Different than the previous one, or kind of in the same place? Getting a little more open, you know. This is exploring ideas with a little bit of sort of holding its nose in disgust, but really exploring them in like gruesome detail. Like really wants to make sure the hairy red anus gets mentioned twice. So you really have to wonder, like, you know, Farmer clearly is a little bit stuck on this concept, and there's like pages and pages and pages more of this. So he's sort of sliding more towards thinking of this in an open context, like maybe this is something interesting, but there's really still not another here. This creature is pretending to be a human and then loses control of itself and turns into a sort of an animal in mid-stride, and he can't quite stop himself because he's too far along, but it's still, you know, an Irish setter that's having fun with him. So Farmer fundamentally conflicted about the whole concept, I think, in most of his writing, and never really takes it any further than that. He just gets stuck on this, as he does more mostly in the homophobic thing. He just keeps getting stuck on the gay thing being really bad but really interesting, but really bad but really interesting, and he doesn't go anywhere. Yeah, compare that to Jack Vance. Two quotes from Jack Vance early in his writing in 1950, Tales from a Dying Earth. He has some mendicants who went on a religious pilgrimage and got lost on the way home and can't find their way back to where they were supposed to be going to. And so what happens is one group of these mendicants splits off and, quote, with the briefest of farewells, they march to the village of the lizard folk. These were sort of huge, you know, lizard-style people, but kind of more lizard than people, where they slaughtered the males, filed the teeth of the females, dressed them in garments of reeds, and installed themselves as lords of the village. Which is sort of an interesting, okay, so the mendicants just gave up on going home. They had walked through a village of lizards, and they thought, well, you know what, if we just put clothes on them and act like they're, you know, people, then that's fine. And they settled down and became lords of the village with their wives as lizards. And true to Jack Vance, it just sort of, okay, it's just part of life on Jack Vance worlds, you know, and if you've read his stuff, it tends to be pretty, you know, out there. And Tales of Dying Earth is very much typical of that. Where do we put that on the horizontal vertical spectrum? Open-minded or conservative in its general perspective? Kind of a little of both. Conservative in that they try to make them, you know, they try to make them look like women, but pretty open-minded in that they're lizards. I mean, you can put reed skirts on them, but it's not like they don't change their bodies. I mean, they're lizards, and he describes them in earlier pages. And they just gave up even, I mean, pretending. So that it's like putting lipstick on, you know, and you know, call it good. And Vance really doesn't make any big stink about this. Like, oh, my God, how terrible. He just, you know, of course, that's what you would do if you were lost. You'd marry the lizards and, you know, have lizard kids. Okay. And his universes tend to be just like that sort of things happen and life goes on and wow. And by 1979, in The Demon Princes, which is really, truly a classic, and I mean that in a genuine way, he tells this story of a planet where there is a sort of a species that diverged from humanity a long time ago and has become kind of a feral, quasi-human species. And they're talking about what happens with their children, and he says, they leave babies lying out on the fells. Simple for forgetfulness, I suspect. Sometimes they're brought in and trained, more or less successfully. Catch them early, and they'll learn to stay clean and walk on their hind legs. Tiptoe, a young female version of this here, is a clever one. She serves beer and fluffs pillows and generally behaves herself. She's fascinating to look at, says Gerson. Is she, well, affectionate? It's been tried with generally poor results, says Maynath. Are you curious? Touch her. Where? Well, to begin with, on the shoulder. And Vance just leaves it at that. Like, he doesn't actually take that that interaction any further. Kind of an interesting interaction, sort of human, sort of not. Sort of suggested that there's some crossbreeding going on here in a sort of weird Jack Vance way. More of an other, I think, in this quote. These are really truly others. And he just kind of throws this in at the towards the end of this book that maybe they're having these others sort of be forced sexual surrogates or something. He doesn't really say anything, but he also doesn't pass judgment on it. He just sort of throws this in as one of those things that the natives do on this particular planet. So I think he's drifted a little more towards an open-ended conception, but more importantly, he's getting a little deeper into a conception of an other as a sexual being that really is an other. It's not just something that's sort of human with fur on it or whatever. And we will go deeper into this as we go. 1984, Across the Sea of Suns, Gregory Benford, one of his classic, relatively early works, a discussion they're having about how to trick some aliens into falling into a particular trap involving black holes and quantum this and so on and so forth. And one of the protagonists suggests that maybe they could use a false a neutrino beam lure because the aliens are thought to have a sexual attraction that is mediated by neutrino beams. In a way that actually kind of makes sense if you read the whole book, because Benford's really, you know, obsessive about making sense. And one of the characters says, "I never speculate on extraterrestrial pornography," which has struck me as a really interesting concept. Like, I mean, when's the last time you really thought about, like, when you think about porn where, abducted by aliens, UFO, you know, people are always imagining the anal probes. It's always the anal probes, you know, okay, we got it, anal probes, we get it. But what do they look at for porn back on their home planet? And I mean, you have to think of them as a sexual being, a sexual species, an alien species, to imagine that they might themselves have pornography that would not just be human porn. I mean, it would be alien porn, right? Because they're aliens. Like, it wouldn't be visual, would it? This actually ties into not only questions that I get asked a lot, but work I do in another part of my life. I train and promote and ride show jumping horses in competition to an international level. And I work almost exclusively with stallions nowadays, mostly for financial reasons, but also because I get on well with them and they do well in sport. And I do, from time to time, consulting internationally for people who are having problems having their stallions breed. The stallion won't do stallion things is usually how the phone call comes. He won't do the, you know, what you know. Well, the you know. What you know. He won't do the thing with the thing. Oh, God. I mean, come on, we're adults. Can you tell me what's going on? And I get shipped around the world to tell people why their stallion just isn't into it. And which ends up being really simple most of the time, actually, but really complicated from a human politics standpoint because the weird assumptions that come into this, and I've had people actually suggest that can we blow up a picture of a mare and put it on the wall? Because then he can... No, because horse porn doesn't work like that. You know what I mean? Like, and then you're actually thinking about what I mean. What's stallion porn? Like, what would it really work? Well, and for me, it's so obvious. Of course, you know it would work. Does anybody want to guess it? Like, if stallions could go to the store and buy stallion porn, what would it be? Smell. Bingo. It's not visual. Same with dogs. You know, you wouldn't have movies. They don't care. They have smellies, right? And they'd look at our porn and think it was as silly as we think smelly porn is to them. So, I mean, extraterrestrial porn, you'd have to imagine, is like, you know, two steps further out. Neutrino beam porn. Fascinating, because you're thinking of other sexualities that are not mammalian really in any meaningful way. But if we're thinking about a sexual universe, then I guess other species probably have their own quirks. And trying to understand them, that's a big cognitive leap. Because we take for granted that there's a certain flavor of sex that is sex. But, you know, what if neutrino beam sex? Can we really make sense of that? We'd have to be relatively clever intellectually to be able to get our hands around that. And I think Benford is poking at that question ontologically and in an interesting way. We'll get back to Benford a little bit later. But that continues forward. 1997, Stephen Baxter, in a collection of short stories called Vacuum Diagrams, another hard science fiction writer, trained as a PhD astrophysicist, smart guy, talking about a character who has been sort of stranded in time and space way out in the middle of nowhere. And that the planet on which he's stranded, a nice person there says, "But you are now stranded, Rhodey. You have now lost your family because he's stuck on this planet without a spaceship to get back to where he's been from." He says, "Yes." And she says, "You're welcome here. You could join my sexual grouping. The surgery required is superficial." Rhodey laughed. "Thank you, but that's well beyond my resources." "Well, what then?" she asks. So the frame here is you've got a human who is on a planet of other kind of humans, but it's been, you know, thousands of years they've been diverging. They have these sexual grouping things, I guess, that are like gender but not. And he could be modified to be part of this new world of sexuality, and then he could participate in their social rituals as an equal, but he doesn't have enough money to do it. And so the constraint has nothing moral at this point. It's just like the difficult challenges of becoming a different sexuality, a different species sexuality. You can do it, but it's expensive. And it would be necessary for him to fit into the culture to become part of their sexual universe. For me, this is a key step the literature takes here, to imagine that sexuality is a component of social organization. And to become part of an outside culture, you need to become part of their sexuality. And how would one change one's sexuality? When we talk about transsexualism and the gender issues in humanity, but what about changing species sexuality? That's a big jump. And if we want to talk about machine sexuality, which is what I'll try to close with in a minute, that's an even bigger jump. Because what if we teach our machines to think in sexual terms? How will they interface with us? And where will they come from as sexual beings? Or do we not teach them in the singularity? Are the machines gendered, or are they all it? We come back now to Greg Egan, Shield's Ladder. Two quotes from this. He is talking about some characters that are sort of generally set up and so far apart in terms of diverged humanity that they're one is doesn't even have bodies. They live in purely in computer space as software, and the other is still physical. And the physical one is talking with the non-corporeal one, and he comments that let's see if I can. Right there is at the sweet spot. He wore a look of such deadpan innocence that Cass felt sure he knew exactly how this sounded in translation. If that was his meaning, the idea wasn't entirely absurd or unwelcome. She'd grown fond of Rainsy, and if he'd never been quite as solicitous or as eager to understand as her Darsono, which was her partner in her sort of species, that truth made him all the more intriguing. This is like being in a windstorm. If they could find enough common ground to become lovers, it might be a fitting way to bid Mimosa, the planet, farewell, sweeping away the mutually distorted views they had of each other. So this is sort of an imagined opportunity for a sexual dalliance between a big spread, a big chasm between almost two species, and imagining that would be a nice way to make a final bond and a nice way to take some... lack of mutual understanding and mutual empathy and make it go away, using sexuality as a lubricant, which is sort of a bad term, but as a social lubricant to bring people, a species, closer together, purely for social value. He continues on, and Cass said haltingly, "No, I'm sorry, I can't join you." And then he thinks to himself, "So much for feeling smugly unshockable for daring to contemplate cross-modal sex." So this is a one step past cross-species sex. It's cross-modal because one is software, one is physical, and they would have to build some kind of a bridge between the two to even have some kind of a sexual interaction. And Cass is trying to think of himself as a sort of au courant modern being in this universe that is willing to consider cross-modal sex, but at the end it just seems a little bit too challenging and a little bit too far out for him to do. Now, with that as our final quote, where do we put that on the spectrum? Is that conservative or open-ended politically? Open-ended. It's about as open-ended as you can get. I mean, there's no moral sort of questioning about whether a cross-modal interaction makes sense. I mean, if you can do it, of course, it helps you understand better. That's a key piece. And is there a truly other in this? I think so, personally. Well, I've read the book too, so I have a little bit of background. But I mean, like these software-based human beings have been, you know, tens of thousands of generations living, you know, in code and have established. Really. Oh, it has to do with that. Okay, like this. Well, that's a lot better. Okay, so there is really an other here, and there's a concept of sexuality that is, you know, so different that it's not even cross-species, it's cross-modal, and it's a software-hardware interface. And this stretches our concept of sexuality to, I think, an interesting place, and this is sort of my argument and some in what I've been talking about today. Sexuality in the mammals, and we're mammals, fulfills a huge number of social functions. Reproduction is one of them, but not the only one. And that is not unique to human beings or unique to primates. Dolphins famously use actually barter sex back and forth routinely between individuals for favors or back scratches or just, you know, quid pro quo, same gender, opposite gender. I mean, this is very common in mammals to use sexuality as a way to build social bonds and to keep people from being mad at each other. And it ends up being really important. And a comment that was made in the previous presentation about the limbic system, you know, we have a lot of aggression comes from our limbic system, and if we could only dampen the limbic system, we probably have less aggression and hopefully less wars because we're such a warlike species. It's an interesting comment because, well, first of all, there isn't a limbic system. There's no part of the brain that is the limbic system. It used to be in the 1950s and the 1960s, there was assumed that there was an emotional brain and then there was a rational brain, and they sort of interacted with one another, and the limbic system was supposed to be the emotional brain, and then the neocortex and stuff was the rational brain. Well, as the neuroscientists have done more fMRI mapping and so on and so forth, it turns out that there is no distinct limbic system to the brain. The emotional components of the brain are intertwined with the other components of the brain so much that you either have to extend the concept of limbic so far that it becomes silly, or you have to just say that there's a brain. And
that's like the reptile brain.
Yeah, people talk about the reptile brain.
There's
no reptile brain. No. And actually, I got this from Dr. Jak Panskep, who is a neuroscientist who, no, very, very well published neuroscientist who I talked with about this, and he was the first one to tell me, Douglas, there is no limbic system. Whoa, really? But it says in the book, I have a book right here, it's limbic. No, we were wrong. There's no limbic system. It's everywhere. The limbic system is all through the brain. So, I mean, we are our emotions. And if you read Antonio Damasio, another neuroscientist, actually a neurologist, Descartes' Error is a book that he wrote about the limbic system, making the same argument that you can't take the emotions out of our brain and have the rational brain left. We are our emotions. And you can't really imagine us as a consciousness with our emotions pulled out, because our entire rationality is built on our emotional framework of what matters and what doesn't. Without emotionality, we're sort of adrift. And if anybody in here is a neuroscience geek and remembers the Phineas Gage example, the guy who got a rod through his head, he lost his emotional interconnections to his cerebral cortex, and lost his ability to make decisions because he didn't care anymore. Without emotion, it doesn't really matter. So the limbic system is a bit of a phantom in human beings, and as we think about ourselves as these conscious beings that are struggling with emotions that maybe we can leave behind as we go forward. The truth is that, as is true for every species we know, at least social species, our emotions are critically interconnected with our social framework and our social capabilities. And if we take the emotions out, we don't have a social species anymore. We can't be social. And sexuality is the center of so much emotional interaction that you can't really think of us without sexuality, without taking so much of our emotional landscape out, that you've then taken out the social landscape, which means you're kind of left with not a lot there. And some of the critiques of the post-singularity stuff I've made have really emphasized that importance of the emotional frameworks. Are we?
In fact, we are like around like 50 minutes now of your talk.
Got it. Okay.
So I think we should open up we should open up the audience. That sounds strange.
with social lubricant.
I'm a German. I'm not a German. I'm speaking German. Okay. Okay. Come here, please. and be gentle to the microphone. It's so poppy.
Okay, I'll be gentle. Microphone. So I wanted to ask if you had have looked into much of cross-species sexuality that's like actually... goddamn microphone. Cross-species sexuality that's actually happening, not just in science fiction. So for example, partly because of, inspired by Annalee Newitz's talk 2 years ago where she was asking, can we imagine sex toys that would let us have sex like octopuses? I did this year-long project asking if we could replace the one-year requirement of real-life experience that transsexuals face with 1 year of second life experience to get species change surgery. And so doing so, I discovered that there's like a large community of people that are very seriously trans species that feel daily on a painful, on a daily basis painfully that they are actually a horse or a fox or something else. So we could look at that as trans species sexuality, right? Or cross species. But also in Second Life, it's really common to be a Nico. Like if you saw our performance last night, our avatars are cross species, like half human, half cat. And so the ones that we use, I mean, so in one sense, there's like people that are really serious about it. In one sense, it's this really common thing because it's fun. And there's this whole complex interplay of species in Second Life. So there's all kinds of species of ears and tails you can buy with all kinds of different attachments and all kinds of different genitalia for different species and tentacles and whatnot. And then on top of that, there's these complex social rules. Like there's some cities where Nikos are allowed, but furries are not. So if you're an anthropomorphic animal, that's not okay. But if you're half human, half cat, then you it's if you're like a cyborg cat and it's plausibly futuristic, then that's okay. But if you're cartoonish, then you're out.
A couple quick comments on that. The world of people who feel like they are trapped in the wrong species body, to some degree, that's a furry world, but not exclusively furry. I'm not really sure we have a good name for that world. That does exist, and those people make strong arguments that they sort of feel similar to being in the wrong gender. I'm not as familiar with the literature on that to really be able to talk to the academic perspective, and I'm not firsthand familiar enough with the community to really talk to the guts of the community, except to say that it is out there, and there are some people who would desperately love to transform permanently in the same way that gender transformation is a goal for some folks because they just feel like they're in the wrong place. A completely different group of humanity, roughly 1-2% of human beings across pretty much all known cultures and all known human history have had physical sexual bonds outside the species, the human species, for as long as humans have been humans. And that kind of cross-species intimacy is as human as consciousness. It has always been with humanity. It has been, of course, socially attacked and pushed down aggressively for in most cultures, and is still as present as it ever was, which suggests that it's got relatively deep roots, and it has something to do with humans and how humans interact with other species in a symbiotic basis. That 1-2% statistic is relatively hard data that's come out of some research in the last 5 years by Dr. Hanny Maletsky, primarily. And yeah, that is a real world. That is a world of folks that live and breathe and get up in the morning and go to bed at night and have bonds across species. And that is a world I know very closely, to put it mildly, and is an interesting, challenging, you know, large open-ended question that I wouldn't want to bog down this too much with, but it's real. And I think that it says some interesting things about how humanity progresses forward in dealing with true others of a machine sort or others of an other species sort, because there are already humans who interface sexually with non-humans in a productive, healthy, mutually reciprocal way. And that's a relatively interesting species skill to have. I think it's in our genes, and it's expressed not that common, but it's there. It's part of who we are. And it ties into our empathetic capabilities, and it's tied into autism in interesting ways. And yeah, that's a couple of days worth of presentations and discussions. There's a lot of unpublished literature, some of which I've written on this, that you could follow up more if you want to.
Thank you. I wondered if you could explain why you chose to plot these different science fiction authors and their works on what I think most people would recognize as the political compass.
Kind of.
And how you think the need to plot it on that political compass influenced your choice of science fiction authors.
It actually went the other direction. It's a good question. I pulled all the quotes I could find that were meaningful and really directly, didn't take five pages of explanation to set up the whole story. Those quotes are pulled from several hundred books of a wide spectrum. It's hard to find them, truthfully. So what happened is I have been winnowing for years quotes and keeping them hidden, sequestered in a little corner of my computer. And I went through and just pulled all my quotes out and read through them and read through them again and tried to make sense of some kind of a taxonomy for where I could put. My first assumption was, well, maybe there's an historical progression. You know, we'll start with the old stuff and get to the new stuff. It didn't really hang together as a historical progression. So then I went to this 2x2 matrix, mostly as a place to throw darts on the dartboard and show that there's different places out there where these cross-species questions can be mapped. But they're not the only two spectra that I think are important and are to a degree arbitrary. I think the most important thing about the spectrum is that there is so little of this in the literature to find, really. It's amazing that you read as much as you do versus the fantasy literature. And keep in mind, in sci-fi, there's a lot of cross-species stuff going on. I mean, there's always aliens and they're hanging out. And Alastair Reynolds, his Revelation Space Universe, five books long now, all sorts of aliens, including aliens that are entire ocean planets. And the S word, the sex word, just like doesn't come up. It just doesn't. It's just like five books. It's not mentioned. So it's somewhat of a hidden question that the science fiction very rarely touches. But when it does, it has interesting things to say, I think.
Yeah, there's actually in the new Ars Electronic book, which came out like 3 days ago. There's I have to. I like to. I think that people should read it. Okay, so there is one story by James Tiptree Jr., who was actually female. It was a pseudonym of Mrs. Sheldon, and she wrote in 1972 this really exciting short story.
There's also a quote from Rudy Rucker, pimping the book here. One reason we're attracted to sex with other people is simply because they're different. Gender isn't necessarily an issue. That's the core idea in both the Delaney and the Sheldon stories. Otherness is a turn-on, and any other person is, for all practical purposes, an alien, if you really think about it. Note that it's not just the difference that turns us on, it's the idea that there's an intelligent mind inside a different body. Another mind that mirrors you, a mind you can in fact pair up with for an endless regress of mutual reflections. I think Rudy Rucker kind of just hits the nail right on the head with that. I mean, that the eroticism of the other is real, and it's a big part of sex. Like, the other is, you know, even if you're same-sex coupling within your species, there's still an otherness there that is attractive. It's interesting. And the intelligence behind the other matters, which is why the replicants, you know, was always kind of a border case. And I think we're going to see a lot more exploration of that idea between the cyborg cross-species blurring lines there as science fiction tries to get its hands around thinking about others as real social entities and not just as foils for ourselves.
A big applause for Douglas Spink. So, okay, so we have just like a 2-3 minute technical like reconstruction here, and then we have Annalyn Newitz. Okay.